Good evening. My name is Laura Takachi, and I am a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of the Clark Forum, I would like to welcome you to this evening's panel discussion, Crime in Carlisle? Just the Facts, Please. This event was initiated by the Clark Forum student project managers. The purpose of tonight's event is to broaden and deepen the discussion regarding personal security and safety that occurred in last week's orientation for incoming students. Students who are new to the area, as well as any current Dickinson students, are invited to ask questions during our question and answer session to alleviate concerns that they might have. Last year, Dickinson students received red alerts on their cell phones on a number of occasions. These messages were in regards to alleged criminal acts committed on and near to campus and conveyed the impression to some students that our campus is unsafe. At the same time, however, Forbes magazine ranked the Carlisle-Harrisburg area as the 17th safest metropolitan area in the United States out of the 200 that they profiled. How should Dickinson students reconcile the red alerts with the Forbes magazine high ranking of Carlisle? Here to help us answer that question are five panelists. Judge Guido, who before being elected to the bench, served as a litigator, an assistant district attorney, and a public defender in Cumberland County. Matthew T. Bennett, who prior to becoming a prevention specialist with the Cumberland Perry Drug and Alcohol Commission, was an investigator for the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections. Lieutenant Michael Dzinski, who has been a member of the Carlisle Police Force since 1994, and Chief Dolores D. Danzer, who has been the Chief of Public Safety at Dickinson College since November 2005. Professor Susan Rose of the Sociology Department and Community Studies Center will moderate tonight's panel discussion. Unfortunately, Mayor Wilson is not with us this evening. He has asked us to apologize for his absence, which is due to an unplanned outpatient surgery, which was conducted earlier this morning. At this time, I would like to remind you to please turn off all cell phones and other electronic devices. Also, since this program is being video recorded, and some of our audience members may be hearing impaired, please wait for a microphone to reach you before asking a question during the question and answer session at the end of the program. Thank you. And now please join me in welcoming our panel.
Good evening, everyone. Thanks for coming. Most of the campus people know me as Dee. I'm the chief of Dickinson College Public Safety. What some of you in the community may not know is that Dickinson is actually a campus police department made up of sworn armed officers with the power of arrest. It's a little bit different than some of our peer institutions in Pennsylvania. Many of those are still security guards who count on the local police to come in and deal with any crimes on their campus. We thankfully work very closely with Carlisle, and I'll talk about that a little bit further, but it's just something I think it's important for everybody to know. So what I can talk about a little bit is from the campus perspective about crime. You know, one of the questions people ask all the time, is Carlisle safe? Well, I think safety is relative. Is Carlisle safe? Yeah, I believe it is. I've worked in small towns, New Jersey, big cities in Florida, and I think the quality of life is very good here, and I think crime is low. One of the reasons I can say that is not just based on personal opinion. One of the things that Lieutenant Dzinski will talk about is that independently, we've each gathered statistics. I did a survey of crime over the last 10 years in Carlisle back in February for the president. And one of the things that I learned that, believe it or not, over the last 10 years, crime rates in Carlisle have remained very consistent. Was a bit of a surprise because based on what's going on in the world and media sometimes, it seems like there's a huge increase. But the reality is that it has remained consistent. Anybody that wants that information, it's no big secret. The way I got it is public access through the FBI website. You can type in any town in the country, and you can pull up the crime statistics. And they're online, available for more than 10 years, 12 years online. So it's basic information that's out there. So when I say Carlisle's safe, I say it based on the facts, based not just on my observation, but on the facts. So is the college safe? Well, crime happens here. Absolutely, it does happen here. Is it fairly safe? Yes. But I do think that safety is a community responsibility. Anytime we have, actually I'm going to pull up some statistics. The college is required, every college in the country is required to report crime statistics to the Department of Education by October 1st of every year. runs about a year behind. So what we just reported, actually we're a little ahead of the curve, it was the 2009 statistics. So that's what I'm going to bring up here for you. Projector me? Okay. So this is basically serious crime on campus, and it's broken down in a number of areas. You get the last 3 years, 07, 08, 09, which is self-explanatory. We break it down into campus, occurs on campus residential facilities, total areas on campus. Non-campus is college-owned buildings that maybe aren't attached to the periphery of the campus. And we actually report crimes that occur on public property, property that does not belong to the college. And that area, what that's described as, is any area immediately adjacent to the college. So, for instance, we go to Carlisle Police Department every year and gather statistics on, say, the 300 block of West High Street. Why do we do that? Well, between Old West and Weiss, any crime that happens on the road or the public sidewalks there, we report. Even though it didn't technically happen in our jurisdiction, we actually do report it. Carlisle reports it through uniform crime reports. We report it to the Department of Education. So all those numbers are compiled, and this is what you get. So one of the things that, you know, stands out to me right away is sex offenses. Last year, there were 5 sex offenses reported to public safety that occurred on campus. There were a number of other incidents that were reported, some of them that did not happen on campus, some of them that were not reported to public safety. If you are the survivor of a sexual assault, just saying you go as a student to the counseling center, that information is confidential. It's not reported in any statistics. Same thing if you were to go to an advocate. So the only statistics that we can report are things that are actually reported to public safety. So when you look at that number 5, there might be some people that say that number's low. To me, that number's bad. If there's a 1 up there, it's bad. None of us want sexual assault in our community. But I really believe over the next couple years that we may see our statistics increase in that area. And I don't think it's because of an increase in crime. I think that there are many more programs. Students are involved in many more ways that are making people more comfortable to come forward and report. And that's what we really want to get at. I'd rather have the number be high and us be able to address it because we're addressing every case that happens than to have a low number, and most of that's because people aren't reporting. So that's one statistic that'll jump out at you a little bit there. Robbery is interesting. You can see in 2008 we reported 4 robberies. Out of those 4 robberies, only 1 occurred on campus. The other 4 occurred in the borough on properties, like I said, public property right around the college. But it's one of the things that we do report. And then you can see some other numbers here, arsons, motor vehicle theft, not a big thing in this area. The number here on burglary is wrong. It is actually 8. Didn't add that in there. But that's the reality of what's going on campus. What's more surprising is, I'm not a Mac person, folks. Statistics by FTE. What we do every year is we take the number of crimes that happen, we take the number of students that are registered at that time, combine it with the number of employees, we come up with this full-time equivalency number. And then we factor in, based on this number, which in this case in 2009 is 3,175, how many of these incidents per person occur? And what you see, that your chance of being a victim on campus is relatively low. The thing that you have the greatest chance of being a victim of on campus is theft, and that's in the area of 1%. So that's the reality. Because we're a small campus, when anything happens, people talk, a lot of information gets out, and I often think, and I had this conversation with Mike earlier, because not a lot of major crime happens in Carlisle, that when it does happen, it becomes big news. This is the facts. Like I said, I'd like to have no numbers in most of those categories. The thing you're most likely to be the victim of is a theft, and that's college campuses across the country, because most people when they come to college have a false sense of security. Very few of us would take our purse, go into a mall in a big city, lay our purse down on a bench and walk around and shop for a while and expect for it to be there when you come back. But people in colleges do that all the time. It's nothing for somebody to put down a book bag in the library, go study in an area and come back in 3 hours expecting their book bag to be there. At Dickinson, most times it is. There are times where it doesn't happen, but most times it is. The reality is that most crime on college campuses and in town are crimes of opportunity. The way you keep crime down, the way you keep from being a victim is there are certain steps that you can take to do that. Public safety has a theme going on this year. You got a bookmark there. It's our five keys for safety success. I think that it's something that can be used in the community and on the college campus, most of them. Simple things like don't walk alone, especially after dark. That should apply whether you live in Carlisle or you live in New York City. And there's some basic things that you can do. Keep your doors and windows locked. It's a small town in Carlisle. I know that coming from a big city, when people talk about crime here, I was like, psh, there's no crime here. I was used to like gunshots and helicopters. But people do leave their doors and windows open, especially in college campuses. It's not uncommon for college students to prop outside doors open because they're waiting for a pizza delivery or a friend to come over. And it's one of the things we encourage students to do is to not keep your doors propped open. Don't worry just about yourself, but think about everybody in your community. Some of the other things that are on there, like I said, don't walk alone. Red Alert is our mask communication system, similar to Carlisle's system, which is like a reverse 911. In the event there's a big traffic incident, they can send phone calls out to everybody. Excuse me. Red Alert is a sign-up. And all students and faculty and staff can sign up. In the event of something that poses an immediate or ongoing threat to your safety, we can send you out messages through text messaging, through your cell phone, through your home phone, through instant messaging, and through email. We always encourage people not to make email your first form of contact because what many people don't realize is that email is not immediate. You know, the college gets tens of thousands of spam messages every day, and there's a million filters that try to factor those things out. So in the event that I sent out an emergency message and it was only through email at the same time that the college's filters were filtering out spam, email could be delayed by up to a half an hour or more. It's one of the reasons that we suggest that everybody puts a cell phone in or their office number for emergencies. I guess the thing I want to address is the thing that you said about the red alerts and is the perception that crime is rampant because of the red alerts. One thing that you should understand is I think that we've been accused of over-red alerting, but I stand by what we've done. There are times where we've sent out red alerts where we have no legal obligation to do so. Legally, we're obligated to do it on when an incident happens on the college property or right outside, like on a sidewalk. But there are certain things that go on in town that we know, because we work so close with the Carlisle police, that we think it's important to tell you about, even though it happened a block away. I will stand by that. I will keep standing by that. And that's the way I will continue to do. Anytime, and I know that Dr. April Barry, who's my supervisor, Vice President of Student Development, feels the same way. We feel very strongly about that. We would rather people tell us you're telling us too much than to not tell enough. I guess last thing I want to touch on a little bit, some peer statistics. Are other college towns as dangerous as they are? Do we have more crime than they are? It's a mixed bag. I will tell you that I did a survey of a number of schools, including Ursinus outside of Philadelphia, Muhlenberg, Swarthmore, Haverford, Washington and Jefferson, Gettysburg, Bucknell, going fast, Franklin and Marshall, Allegheny, Skidmore, and Union. Things like burglaries, we are way below everybody else. Gettysburg, I can tell you, where's their burglary statistic? They reported 12 burglaries in 2008. We had four. When I look at Bucknell, Bucknell had 18. We had four. Things, definitely property crimes, thefts, we run way behind our peer institutions. Things like aggravated assault were about the same. Unfortunately, forcible rapes. I think one is too many. Like I said, some schools report higher statistics than we do, and we're higher than some others. I'm trying to think where I was going to go from there. I wanted to compare. That's one of the questions that come up, are we safer than other schools? And I guess the last thing that I would say is that we have an incredibly good working relationship with Carlisle Police. If you weren't around in February, you missed it. That's when we had a couple assaults, one off campus, one on campus. Unfortunately, both the victims were college students. We worked incredibly well with Carlisle Police because we did red alert the first one, which was not on campus. We were able to gather some information, especially after the second one. A college employee who got the red alert said, I think I saw someone like that in one of the buildings, one of the public access buildings. The reality is we were able to go into our video camera system because we have to have surveillance cameras throughout the campus, get both a video and a still image of this person who then was identified. Carlisle worked with their detectives, with the victims, identified it as the perpetrator. The next day, we put all this stuff out, actually that night, the next day to LIS employees at the college are on the job, see this guy, they go, oh my God, we think that's the same guy we just saw on the news. They follow him, they're on the phone with public safety. Public safety officer comes, stops the guy, Carlisle comes, makes the arrest. I can tell you that would not have gone down that way if we didn't have the relationship that we do. Many schools are not in that position. And the worst time that you can try to develop a relationship is when the you know what's hit the fan. You need to have that kind of relationship ahead of time. It's something that we've enjoyed with them for years. Our officers have been trained by their training folks for years. We train certain things together, and I can't say enough about Carlisle Police. That's basically what I have to say at this point. Public safety, all our crime statistics are online on our website. There's a ton of other information out there that's available to anybody. One of the best things you can do is just make yourself educated about what your community is like. Check the crime statistics. If you live in Carlisle, crimereports.com, which Mike is going to talk about, you can go in and put the college address in or your address in. You could actually sign up so that any time a crime happens in Carlisle near your house that you actually will get an email alert. I do. I have it even though I don't live in town because I want to know what's going on. So it's one of the things I think that we all do very well, both Carlisle and us, is communicate what's going on in the community and crime. Sometimes like it seems there's a lot of crime, but I think it's because we want everybody to know as much information as possible. Thank you.
That's a great segue. Mike Kaczynski.
Thank you. Can everybody hear me okay if I stay here behind the table? I've got a lot of notes, and I'm left-handed, so that automatically means I need a lot of space, so I apologize in advance.
And he's standing up.
And I'm standing up. Judge doesn't know I've got a taser right now. As the introductions indicated, my name is Lieutenant Mike Kaczynski. I've been with the Carlisle Police Department for just about 16 years now. Prior to that, I spent some time in the military. I worked undercover narcotics, so I've got a pretty good feel for the Carlisle area. The one thing I can promise you here this evening is that I will give you my best answer, the gut answer. I won't try and dress it up for you. I won't try and make it sound better than it necessarily is. And if I can't come up with an answer, then I'll get back to you on that. We were provided with a set of 14 questions before this evening's forum. Basically, we wanted to try and prepare answers for those questions. I obviously cannot cover all 14 questions within my allotted 10 minutes. So what I did is I picked a series of four or five questions, and I'm going to address those, and I'm sure that the rest of them will probably come up here in a Q&A session. First question, what are the root causes of crime in Carlisle? That's probably the answer of the evening, or the question of the evening. I'm guessing we probably have 60, 70 people here in attendance this evening, and I'll bet if we ask each of you your cause or your belief for the cause of crime in Carlisle, we would probably have 60 or 70 different answers. From my perspective, there's two things that I think come into play. Decline in values and personal responsibility. I think that's across the face of the map. I don't think that applies to just Carlisle. I think that applies to everywhere in the country. I am 44 years old, and I see things on a daily event in the streets of Carlisle and on the national news that still perplex me to no end. I don't understand the values that come across in society today. I don't understand the things that are acceptable in society today. Can I fix that? No. What I can do is I can help control the 18,000 people that live within the confines of Carlisle Borough and try and keep the laws in force as best as possible. One of the best illustrations I use for the decline in personal responsibility and values, at face value, seems like it's a minuscule event, and those are hit-and-run accidents. We have 50 hit-and-run accidents since June of this year. That's 50 incidents where somebody struck another vehicle and made a conscious decision to leave. I don't understand that. I understand there may be a few numbers in there where somebody's driving an oversized tractor trailer, they clip a mirror, they're not aware of it. I promise you that is the minority. The majority of these are people who ran into somebody else's property and then consciously decided to leave the scene and leave that person to be a crime victim. Where does that come from? I have no explanation. The only thing I can tell you is that you cannot describe the frustration to the motorist who comes out after eating a slice of pizza at George's or attending a movie somewhere in the downtown Carlisle area or enjoying a family dinner to come out and find their mirrors no longer attached to their car or their entire side of their vehicle has been sideswiped by a vehicle who not only knew the damage was there but kept going. A small crime, but a good illustration. Another reason I believe we have some causes of crime in Carlisle: instant gratification. The work ethic that I grew up with doesn't necessarily seem to feed through on everybody we deal with as Carlisle Police Department. Illustration of that. We make an arrest of somebody who maybe broke into several vehicles. He broke into a house. She broke into a house. She stole property. Why did you do it? Because I wanted it. Why did you steal from them? Because they have and I don't have it. The haves and the have-nots. Nowhere in the mentality of some of the folks that we're dealing with does it occur to them that you have a $200 iPod in your vehicle because you worked for it. You have a $300 GPS in your vehicle because you worked for it. That's not the message that comes through during our interviews and our interrogations and our confessions. It's simply that you had it, they wanted it, and they took it. One other thing that I can't explain how that comes to be, but I know that that is one of the deep root causes of crime across the country, not just here in Carlisle. Second question, what types of crime occur in Carlisle? Predominantly property crimes. In 2008, they made up 88% of our totality of crimes. 2009, they made up 93% property crimes alone. That means somebody either burglarized your home, they stole your vehicle, they broke into your vehicle, they stole property from your front porch, your back shed, whatever the case may be. That is a large number. That, however, is a positive number when you look at it a certain aspect. As Dee indicated, we have some perception that we have a major violent crime problem in Carlisle. When 93% of your crime involves the theft of an ornament from a front porch or a GPS from a car, although that is very traumatic to the victim, that does not necessarily mean you have a serious crime problem. In fact, if you turn on the news or you open the local newspaper and you see that a violent crime occurred in Carlisle, that tends to be on the first page or maybe underneath the first fold. That's a good indication to me that those stories don't necessarily happen on a daily event. I turned on the news recently and I saw that Harrisburg had its 11th homicide. The news was running for 2 minutes before that story came on. That was, for good, bad, or indifferent, something that happens in certain parts of the country. Carlisle, if that was to happen, you can imagine how the story would read out. You'd have teams of reporters on every intersection of that entire block talking about that homicide. It doesn't happen that often. Gratefully, it doesn't happen that often, but it does happen. So property crimes tend to be the largest majority of crimes in Carlisle. That is a bad statistic, but it is a good statistic in the fact that we don't have a lot of violent crime. Who are the perpetrators and why? Well, I think the panel here may be able to talk about that a little bit more in detail, but from our experience, I think that determines what kind of crime you're talking about. DUIs, that's across the board. We will see doctors, we will see nurses, attorneys, cashiers, clerks, you name it. DUIs affect every segment of population, every segment of society. However, the crimes that we see which tend to be more violent in nature or more property-related in nature tend to be committed by folks that are of lower income or economically challenged. I think that goes back into the first point I was talking about, the haves and have-nots. They sometimes believe that they just have a right to have the property because they want it. I can't change that statistic. I can just tell you that our observations are those are the folks that tend to commit those type of crimes. The robberies, the rapes, the one homicide we had, unfortunately, they fall into that category as well. They tend to necessarily put themselves into positions where the education may not have gone as far as it should have. They may not have had the upbringing they should have, and they tend to be very angry, and they take it out on society. And unfortunately, some of the folks in this room end up being the victims of those crimes. Is there a drug trade in Carlisle? Yes. There's a drug trade in every town across the country. Can things be worse? I assure you they can. For those of us that were around probably in the late 90s and the early 2000s, Lieutenant Mike Guido back there is a retired Carlisle officer. He's now with Dickinson Public Safety He and I could probably sit here for 2 hours telling you stories about things that happened in certain parts of town in the late 90s. Things were bad. You could pretty much drive to any street corner, buy a rock of crack cocaine for 20 bucks and keep going. Have things gotten better? Oh my, yes. Do we still have a problem? Sure. But when you drive around town now, you're not necessarily going to be able to flag somebody down and buy crack cocaine. It's not going to happen. Can you buy marijuana? Can you buy cocaine? Sure. Are we dealing with a large heroin problem? A little bit. Are we dealing with as much of a heroin problem as some of the cities around us? Not even close. Have you opened up the local newspaper lately and found a meth lab in Carlisle? Thank goodness, no. They're a disaster. What are we having the biggest problems with right now? Pharmaceuticals, painkillers, prescription drugs. The easy answer is, you know, those are adults who were injured, they got on medication, and for some reason they got addicted to these pills. That's the easy answer. The hard answer is a lot deeper. It's the kids. They have what's called farming parties, and that's spelled P-H, not F. PH, farming parties, as in pharmaceutical parties. They will go into the parents' medicine cabinets. They'll take a couple pills from each bottle. Parents aren't going to notice. They show up, and all of a sudden it's a party. Everybody takes whatever color pill they want off the table, and they combine them, and they see what happens. You can't get any more dangerous than that, but it is popular. It's popular across the country, and we are not immune from that. Having said that, the biggest arrests we seem to be making lately deal with the painkillers. People falsifying prescriptions, people selling their drugs and coming into the police department, filing a report saying someone stole my drugs, I need a prescription, or I need a police report so I can go get some more. Happens probably on a biweekly basis at least. We naturally are very suspicious of those, but unfortunately, because painkillers are so high value in the street, we tend to have to treat the victims a little bit more cautiously because we're not sure if they actually sold the drugs or if they were put in the house or in the car and somebody knew they were there and they sold them. Because you can get just about as much for a painkiller pill right now as you can for a rock of crack cocaine. That is the shame of it. How does distribution of wealth affect crime in Carlisle? Wealthy are less likely to be crime victims. They are. Whatever reason you want to draw from that, they are simply less likely to be crime victims. The wealthier folks don't tend to put themselves into situations. They don't tend to walk at 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the morning intoxicated. They don't tend to walk alone. They tend to live in areas which are a little bit more affluent and have a little bit more proximity between the homes. Good example of that. If, for those of you that are familiar with the Meeting House Heights area, if you have somebody walking through Meeting House Heights at 2 o'clock in the morning, walking beside parked cars, I can assure you our phones are blasting off the hook. Not because necessarily the person doesn't live there, but because you don't necessarily see somebody walking up the street 2 o'clock in the morning in Meeting House Heights. It just normally doesn't happen. Is it abnormal to see somebody walking on West Pomfret Street at 2 o'clock in the morning? No. On a Thursday night when the bars let out, you might as well just put a crossing guard out there. So that's not abnormal. Is that saying that wealthy people don't live on West Pomfret Street? No. But it's saying that generally they don't put themselves into situations where they tend to be victims of crime. Do they have their homes burglarized? Do they have their cars broken into? Yes. Does it happen with as much propensity as other segments of the population? It does not. It does not, in my experience. Which leads me to crime prevention, and that's how I want to spend my final 2 minutes if I could. This is addressed to everybody in the room, but with target on the college population. Please. Do not walk alone at night. I see some of you back there. I'm hoping you hear me. I'll yell it if I have to. Do not walk alone at night. The victims we had in those assaults last year did not do anything wrong. Please do not interpret my comments as to indicate that they did anything wrong. But they were all alone. All the girls that were attacked last year were alone. It was nighttime. I understand we want to feel safe and are secure in our environment, and I assure you, all 30-some members of the Carlisle Police Department strive for that every day, but we can't be everywhere at once. We cannot provide a safe cocoon for you to be able to walk along at midnight down an alley that happens to come up beside your apartment and give you any kind of assurance that you're going to be safe. You need somebody with you. Please don't interpret that as saying, if I'm talking to my best friend on the cell phone, that doesn't count as being alone. You're alone. Unless that friend knows exactly where you are, sees exactly what you see, and is able to present themselves in a way to protect you, you are still alone. Walking intoxicated. We have had some victims that have been walking intoxicated. They might as well put a sign on their back that says, please rob me. All right? People that are out looking for intended crime victims are keeping a good eye on what you're doing. They may be sitting next to you in the bar. They may watch you walk out intoxicated, see you stumbling down the block. If they're looking for a crime victim, I assure you, they're going to stay about a half block behind you, and they're going to wait for you to make that turn into that dark alley in that dark corner, and that's going to be it. They're going to jump you. Their friends may jump you. They're going to take your stuff. If you're walking intoxicated, you are assuredly asking for trouble. Please do not do it. Lock your possessions. This applies to everybody within Carlisle Borough. Of the summer, since June 1st, we've had over two dozen thefts from vehicles where somebody has gone into a vehicle and they've taken property. I use the word thefts loosely, however, because of those, almost 60% of the vehicles were unlocked. Those are tough crimes to solve. When you make it possible for somebody to open up your car door, rifle through your car, shut the door, and you come in the next morning and don't notice your property's gone until you go to use that GPS or you go to pull that $3 and change for the toll, it makes it very difficult to solve. The perpetrators of those crimes know people leave their car doors unlocked. They're going to walk through and they're going to check car doors until they find one that's unlocked. If you lock your car door, does that mean you won't necessarily be a victim of a theft? No. If you leave your GPS or your cell phone or your computer in the car and it's visible and your car door is locked, they're going to go in and get it. But if you don't leave that stuff visible and you leave your car door locked, I assure you, they're not going to make all that noise going through that side window and risk getting arrested with maybe trying to get 50 cents out of the center console. It's not going to happen. Be aware of the view from outside. I wrote that note down and I wasn't sure how to best say it. I'm losing track of the amount of times our officers have been on foot patrol and they've seen females in windows who weren't necessarily showing an extensive amount of modesty. All right? I'm trying to tap dance around this the best I can. You need to close your blinds, folks. All right? If somebody's out there trying to find a potential victim of a sexual assault and you show up in your nightgown in front of the window and it's 2 o'clock in the morning and you're walking in front of the window like it's nobody's business, you're making yourself a target. I wish I could say that's not the case, but it is. Finally, and I know I'm getting the time minute warning, this is the point I did not want to miss. Our victims last year did one thing great across the board. They fought. And they fought some more. And they screamed. And they kicked. And they clawed. And they gouged. That's exactly what I need you to do. Do not interpret that as me telling you don't give up your property. If somebody shows up and they're robbing you, give the property up. Get a good description, let us deal with it. If somebody is intent on harming you and dragging you into an alleyway or dragging you into a dark corner, as happened last year, I want you to kick, I want you to scream, I want you to bite, I want you to do everything possible. There's a saying that goes along in certain segments of law enforcement. If your life is in danger and you're in a fight, if you're playing fair, you're going to lose. I want you to convey that message to everybody around you. If they're going to kill you and they're going to rape you and they're going to do things that are going to cause you harm, make them pay for it dearly. Claw, kick, scream, punch, gouge, do whatever you have to do. Those girls last year were all very successful in staying out of harm's way for the most part. They did because they fought. All right? I appreciate it. Thank you.
I don't want to lose the moment real quick, but the other thing they did right is they called the police immediately.
Yeah, good point.
And that makes life a lot easier to solve a crime.
I apologize for going late.
Good evening. My name is Ed Guido. I was a student here about 40 years ago, and I must say that the student body has gotten a lot older than when I was here.
You want my glasses?
But I had been a public defender for a good many years, about 8 years, a district attorney for about 8 years, and in private practice for a good many years before I took the bench, and I've been on the bench now for 13 years. And those of us that deal in the criminal justice system tend to get a jaded view of humanity. And we come to things like this tonight and scare the bejesus out of you. Let me start by saying that this is a great community to live in. Our incidence of crime compared to other communities around the state makes it very safe. I think Dee gave the statistic that, this young lady, that out of the 200 metropolitan areas, and Cumberland County is not a metropolitan area, and I think that's one of the reasons it's such a great place to live. We don't have a lot of serious crime in Cumberland County, and I'm talking about violent crime. As Lieutenant Dzinski said, Harrisburg just had its 11th murder last night. In this county, in the 35 years I've been here, murders come one, at most two a year, and often not even one a year, and that's in the whole county. In the borough itself, it's less than that. So it's really a good, safe place to live. That being said, you've got to protect yourself, and there are violent crimes that occur within the county and in the borough in particular, because the borough is the closest thing we have to a metropolitan area in Cumberland County. And a colleague of mine once said the reason that Cumberland County doesn't have the type of violent crimes you see in other counties is because we have no real metropolitan area. We don't have a Harrisburg. We don't have a Reading. We don't have a Philadelphia or Pittsburgh. And that tends to keep down the violent crime. So I'll go on and answer some of the questions. Some fascinated me. The root causes of crime. I list them as stupidity, drugs, greed, and passion. And pretty much in that order. And who perpetrates crimes? And I'm not going to be as specific as Lieutenant, you've been promoted.
I know.
It's amazing. They made my brother a sergeant. I can't believe you guys are effective as you are.
He said it, not me.
There are two types of perpetrators. There are mean people, and there are stupid people or smart people doing stupid things. The vast majority of crimes committed in this county are by the second part, by the stupid people or smart people doing stupid things. Crimes of passion, crimes of greed, crimes of impulse. In my 35 years working in the criminal justice system, I can count on my hands the number of mean people I've encountered. Actually, the mean people, the ones that have scared me. The rest are drug addicts. They're stupid. They got addicted. They're feeding their habit. They see an open car and see the chance of picking up $3. So they take it. The rape certainly is a concern on the college campuses. I don't think it's any bigger concern than it was when I was here 40 years ago. But my generation was incredibly misogynistic. In other words, we devalued women. And women devalued themselves. Just watch the sitcoms from the 1960s. Bewitched, for instance, where, you know, you live for the husband, you serve the husband. The sexual assaults weren't reported in my day. And they're reported more often now because of the strides that have been made. The rape cases that come before me, the vast majority of them are between people that know each other and know each other well. It's not the rape that you see on television by the complete stranger. Those are the mean people that are going to rape a stranger. That other situation are the stupid people. And the difference between the portrayal of crime on TV and crime in real life is that difference between mean people and stupid people. Most crime in real life is impulsive, not planned out, and not committed by mean people. On television, Everybody's got a motive. The crimes are always planned out, and they're almost always really mean people. I mean, Leroy Jethro Gibbs never arrests anybody that's not really mean. Okay, so that's the difference. The types of crimes, and I'm not sure you included that in your statistics, but what I see, what gets to me, like the stealing of the lawn ornament doesn't make it up to court. But the crimes that come before me, far and away, drunk driving is the most numerous, the most often committed crime or prosecuted crime in this county. The drunk driving cases amount almost as much as all other crimes that are prosecuted combined. And I don't know how your arrest records come down that way. But, and from my standpoint, among the most dangerous people that come before me are the multiple offender drunk drivers. And that may be a statement all of you don't agree with, but when you think about my how I categorize people, I've only had a 8 to 10 mean people I've dealt with in 35 years. Okay, most of the harm inflicted in property and damage in this county are by drunk drivers and the multiple offender drunk drivers that haven't learned. You know, the smart person doing something stupid has a few too many drinks, gets arrested for drunk driving. My God, the light goes on. And the keys are given up very quickly after that, or they recognize I've got a problem. It's the guy or the girl that keeps getting arrested and doesn't admit to the problem. And they're the dangerous ones. Is there prostitution in Carlisle? Who asked that question? Who wants to know? Of course, where you've got men with money and but there are no houses of prostitution, I don't think. When I was in school here,
not
there
since
was.
Bessie, no.
Bessie's was here, and she had been an institution since the Civil War. Most of the prostitution takes place at the truck stops. Most of it that I see is drug-related. In other words, the women selling their bodies for drugs or for money to buy drugs. This was an interesting question. The trucking industry, how has it influenced crime in Carlisle or Cumberland County? And I was in the DA's office in the 90s that Lieutenant Dzinski was talking about. And I guess it was sometime in the mid-80s that they finished the Wade Bridge on 81 that then had 81 and the Turnpike intersecting in Carlisle. Before that time, most of the violent crime in Cumberland County are like the rapes that I still see among people or between people that knew each other. Buddies getting in bar fights, husbands shooting wives, wives shooting husbands. After they finished that bridge and after the drug traffic came from New York into Carlisle, the violent crime tended to be against strangers. The violent crime tended to be drug trafficking related. And you got a lot more crime of people killing people they didn't know. We had an arrest just this past weekend on a 9-year-old murder where drugs were involved, prostitution was involved for the drugs. And that changed, I say, when the Wade Bridge was done. Obviously, I have no statistics. These are all based upon experience. I think that about covers what I had to say.
Good evening. My name is Matthew Bennett, and I'm with the Cumberland Perry Drug and Alcohol Commission. My commission addresses alcohol, tobacco, and other drug issues within Cumberland and Perry County. And some very good points and observations have been raised here this evening. And let me just say that substance abuse, along with several other variables, can lead to criminal activity. I think that's very well illustrated If you look at state and county inmates, substance abuse played a role in 70% of those inmates ending up incarcerated. I think it was a little bit higher in Cumberland County. I think we're about 82%, but 70% of state and county inmates, there was a substance abuse issue that led to their incarceration. Also, it doesn't matter where you are. If you have people, you're going to have positive and negatives. It takes a group of people to have crime. It takes a group of people to get together and have a bake sale or a charity. That's just the nature of our species and who we are. The crime that can be a byproduct or linked to substance abuse, it can take many forms. DUI is a, unfortunately, an all too common example of that, especially the habitual offenders who not only put themselves, but the community and anyone unfortunate enough to be in their path when they are driving at risk is something we see a lot here of in Cumberland County. But then there is blue-collar crime, which may be more violent, maybe the following the individual home after the bar lets out. You'll see the white-collar crime, where it would be stealing of money or something of those nature to support a drug habit. Then you see the sexual assaults, the date rapes, child endangerment, parental neglect are things that you see that can have a, that substance abuse can play a hand in. Then you see the fringe, the other costs such as emergency room visits, spread of HIV, whether it be needles or through unwise decision making while someone's impaired. The list goes on and on and on. So what do you do to address substance abuse and the negative effects such as crime? Well, the Cumberland Perry Drug and Alcohol Commission, we incorporate a three-unit strategy to address this. First unit would be what's called the case management unit. This is for individuals ages 18 or over who either by court order or by their own volition have sought assistance and help with their substance abuse problem. And they would come to the commission and they would receive evaluations. They would be put in touch with the appropriate organization or facility that would help them address those problems. The other unit that we have is called the Student Assistance Program. And I like to call that our first line of defense or assistance. What they are substance abuse specialists that are embedded in the schools. If there is a problem at a young age, and substance abuse is not limited to older adolescents, it's across the board. Age-wise, socioeconomic-wise, this isn't just the kid in the corner with the hooded sweatshirt up and the pants hanging halfway down. This is all across the board we're seeing this. If you have a student in the middle school is showing signs of drug use, drug experimentation, and a teacher sees it, if a parent has a concern, if a fellow student sees it, referrals can be made, and we can nip it in the bud, if you will. We can get this student help. And early identification and prevention is key, we feel. The third and final unit, which is the unit that I belong to, is the prevention unit. Our branch of the commission works within the community. We serve on various coalitions. We will do trainings. I think in the last month I've been in front of law enforcement doing training as well as students doing lectures. We deal with educators and military installations all across the board discussing current drug trends, signs, symbols, the vernacular, what we're seeing, what's falling out, what's on the horizon. What areas similar to ours are experiencing. And I can tell you with what our commission is seeing, we're seeing the big three, alcohol, tobacco, and marijuana. But right on the outside, coming up strong fourth, in fourth place, that horse is called prescription and over-the-counter drug abuse. This is not something unique to Carlisle. It is a national problem that we're seeing. And it is gaining ground, unfortunately. And those are the big four that we see. And to talk about one of the questions here was specifically about what the community does. How does the community work? Well, let me touch upon the prescription over the counter drug problems. Yes, it's a big issue. The Office of National Drug Policy estimates conservatively that 2,512 to 17-year-olds a day start to experiment with prescription over-the-counter drugs. And it's not from the shady person in the corner in the black trench coat and the fedora wringing their hands saying, I'm going to get middle America's youth. No, it's from friends. It's from peers. It's from their friend's house. How often, you know, everyone locks their liquor cabinet and their gun cabinet, but no one really locks the medicine cabinet. If you have a box of this big of horse pills that are oxycodone or what have you, if one or two are palmed, are you going to notice right away? No, you're not. Well, anyway, that's given us some issue. So the community is coming forth, and I'm very proud of some of the initiatives that the Carlisle area is doing. We do the prescription take-back program, and is a great program that what we do is we have multiple agencies within the community, members from Dickinson College, from Shippensburg University, the Carlisle Police Department, the Drug and Alcohol Commission, the Waste Management. They have all come together because we all have a stake in the community, and they organize prescription take-back programs to take these drugs out of the community. We're happy at the commission because less addictive drugs in the community, less of a problem that we're going to have to deal with. Law enforcement's happy because these drugs are out of the community and something that they don't have to deal with, the criminal aspect. The environmental waste management's happy because if they're properly disposed of, they're not being flushed down the toilets and polluting the water table. So you take different groups that may on paper think, well, gee, these guys aren't ever going to hang out together. We're perfect allies to address this problem, which illustrates the point that crime, like substance abuse, has many factors. And there's not one countermeasure that we can wave a magic wand and address them. Same, but if we all pull together and bring in many members of the community, we can really, really make this a good place to live, a better place to live. And I believe that's everything I have.
We're going to very soon open up to questions from the audience, but I'd also like to ask, a couple of you touched a little bit on this, but do you think the economic recession and the increasing unemployment has affected crime at all in Carlisle?
I'm always asked if the recession has hurt my business, and I say my job is recession-proof. I don't think it's increased it. The types of crimes that are committed around here aren't people stealing to feed their family. They're the crimes of impulse. My experience has been it's about the same. But I'll defer to the man in the street.
Is the recession and unemployment used as an excuse? Yes, a lot. However, when you look a little deeper, it's sometimes difficult to actually buy into that. The person who's at Giant, and we won't be naming names, but they're wearing Giant, and they're not stealing meat, they weren't stealing potatoes, they were stealing makeup dispenser type products. So although we hear it a lot as an excuse for the crime, generally when you look a little bit deeper at the perpetrator, they haven't always had a job anyway, so it wasn't there to lose, and typically the stuff they stole wasn't necessarily part of their basic sustenance.
If I may, I believe Cumberland County is well known for having a very low unemployment rate within the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And we're well known for having a consistently low unemployment rate. So I think that may be something to factor in as well when you hear that reason given for crime.
Mm-hmm. One last question before we open up. What do you do with the drugs when you take them back?
prescription drugs take-back programs.
Yeah. When is the program delivered?
There are many rules and regulations. And then, once again, it's about different agencies within the community coming together. It may be waste management, properly disposing of them, following the guidelines. There have been different programs area where the Pennsylvania National Guard comes in their large armored vehicles and removes them. They're taken to a secure facility and incinerated. And what's great is when you pool those resources and you pool the community members together, you've got all your bases covered. An organization like my commission, we could not do something that on our own. Brings everyone together, then they are properly disposed of.
Mm-hmm. And this is announced through the newspapers, or is it an annual?
We try and do two a year. We have one coming up on September 25th in Silver Springs. I know it's Carlisle, but they're nice people over there, too, in Silver Springs Township. Also, we've been doing this for several years, and we've great success. It's been a homegrown effort. We're seeing that the DEA is now initiating some take-back programs on the same date, September 25th, as ours, and we're thinking the more the merrier. If someone would like additional information, I'm going to be loitering, which you're allowed to do, I believe, here, since I was invited on campus. I'll be loitering around afterwards. Come see me, and I can give you information about prescription take-back program and tell you about proper ways to dispose of your meds, because once again, if they're properly removed from the community, it makes, I believe, everyone's job up here a little bit easier.
We had one on campus about a year ago, about the same time of the year as U-Turn. At the end of the year, our students know that at the end of the year we have a program called U-Turn, where if you're moving out of your residence halls, instead of putting stuff in the dump or in the garbage, we collect up things, and then it's sold at a giant yard sale, all benefiting United Way. And about a year or so ago, we had a drug take back at the same time.
It was very successful.
It was very successful, and it's certainly something that we would look to partner with them again.
Excellent.
And you didn't sell the drugs at the yard sale?
No.
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 No. Most of the drugs are disposed the same way, illegal drugs are disposed. So, illegal drugs come into, just say, either Carlisle Police or Public Safety, make the arrest. Once the case has gone to court or it's over and done with, and then the way we do it is we turn our stuff over to Carlisle and then it's incinerated. So.
And I also just want to mention, because I see Marcy standing there. Marcy maybe can come out here just a little bit, but and this
nice
has
try.
To do with
Rad.
Mike's, with Rad and Mike's comment in terms of fighting back. And Marcy, do you want to do 30 seconds about Rad?
Here on campus, we have a program. It's called Rad. It's actually a national organization. It's rape aggression defense class. It's strictly for women. We teach the ladies different options, how to use physical as well as mental to try to avoid the risks of being attacked and what you look for, and just being more aware of their surroundings. It's a 15-hour class that we hold here on campus on a regular basis, and we're also working to open it up to the community.
Excellent. And also counts for phys ed credit, right?
Right.
So major plus. Well, I want to thank each of the panel members for very interesting, informative presentations. And would now, I think we have two of the Clark Forum students who have microphones. We're going to first, I think, address student concerns and questions, and then open that up.
Yeah. Hi, my name is Ian Mandel, and I'm a senior here at Dickinson. So I want to touch on something that Mr. Bennett touched on. I know that drug prescription abuse is a huge problem at Dickinson. I was wondering if there are statistics regarding drug abuse on other college campuses around the Pennsylvania area, and also in the just in the community, and if there's a relationship, if there's a greater drug abuse problem on campuses rather than in public high schools or just in the community, and if there's education programs in public high schools or public colleges about prescription drug abuse, and if they're successful or not. Thank you.
Oh, okay. You packaged a few in there, a few questions in there. That was very efficient. Well done. Talking about the prescription drug abuse on campus, yes. Once again, that ties into, this isn't the adolescent with the bad haircut listening to worse music real loud on the corner. This is through all levels of society. Now, we're even seeing the older generations an older generation that maybe was dominated the 60s now are using at levels that are rivaling adolescence. So we're seeing a full continuum. Yes, we're seeing a spike. We're seeing a lot of Adderall. I'll do trainings, and I can show you examples of mouse pads, of T-shirts that says Adderall, the Ivy League crack. I can show you T-shirts that say, you know, Adderall can't pass without it, that you can purchase online. So, yes, it is on the campuses. We are seeing a rise in it. Statistically, I couldn't give you those numbers off the top of my head, but I can. You talk to me later. We can. I can get you those. But we're seeing it across the board. But, you know, then you're seeing the constant horses of alcohol, tobacco, and marijuana there as well. And then you touched upon education. We are now that we've seen and we are seeing people coming into the commission or law enforcement or going through the court system, when we find out what they're doing, then we're like, all right, so we're having a problem with A, B, C, and D. We're going to address those. Maybe 5 or 6 years ago, we wouldn't have talked to in high school about the dangers of prescription over-the-counter drug abuse or robo-pounding or tussing, which is the abuse of cough syrup, Robitussin cough syrup or Tussin. We're drinking that and chugging that in the corner or what have you, or inhaling various household chemicals. But when we see a new trend, it's our responsibility to go and specifically educate the community, the educators, and the student bodies to those. So, yes, we are doing that, and if something comes out next week, right now everyone's talking about this synthetic marijuana now. We're seeing just a tiny blip about it, but if the community would like information on it, it's our responsibility to be proactive and reactive get that information out there and educate. Did I cover maybe half of what you okay.
I have a comment on your answer because it kind of strikes me as a little strange.
Okay.
Knowing that tobacco is a dangerous drug without question, I find it strange to be placed into this discussion on crime, because in all the years that I've been involved in the criminal justice system, I've never seen tobacco been a driving force behind a crime being committed, whereas alcohol, marijuana, and the other illegal drugs or drugs legally used dangerously are.
Usually what we do is we include tobacco as a gateway drug, as in it is a drug, and if someone would be using tobacco, progression of drug use, the next step may be something stronger, and then maybe it would be marijuana or alcohol. So when we look at the whole continuum of use, that is often a first step, if you will. And then with the underage purchasing and such, we used to coordinate that through our office for the underage sales and what have you. So it's part of the pie. So when we say alcohol, tobacco, and other drugs, we're just trying to cover everything with our stroke, okay, with our brush.
Good evening. My name is Timothy Damon. First, I'd like to thank the Clark Forum and our panelists for this event tonight, and especially the members of the Carlisle and College community who are here. I think it's a hopeful sign that so many people care on what is otherwise a rather depressing topic. My question for the panel has to do with what Judge Guido mentioned about the most dangerous people being the repeat DUI offenders. Because, yes, when we have a murder or a homicide, something that makes a big impact, it gets a lot of media attention, and everyone focuses on it. But that would be one person who was killed, as opposed to the number of people who are affected by accidents that result from drunk driving. So what can we do as policymakers? Do you have any recommendations with your experience? What can we do as a community to try to address what is a more hidden but dangerous problem?
Interestingly, as I was reading my Newsweek this morning, There was an article, I believe, about a pilot program in North Dakota where they've recognized the seriousness of the multiple DUI offender, and they've got intense probation and require them to have not drink for the period of their probation and submit to portable breath testing twice a day. And they have cut their number of alcohol-related deaths in half. And I've cut that out, and I'm going to give it to my probation department to look into. So that's just one thing that came up. A lot has been done in the past 30 years to reduce the carnage. The drunk driving used to be considered one of those social crimes when I was growing up. In 1983, Pennsylvania passed a drunk driving reform act that carried with it mandatory terms of imprisonment for drunk driving, carried with it mandatory terms of imprisonment for homicide by vehicle involving drunk driving. And that really did cut down the drunk driving deaths in Pennsylvania. So there have been steps taken. There are more steps that can be taken.
I'm also interested if there's any research on whether young people or older people are actually assigning a designated driver. Has that actually taken hold? Is anybody aware of research?
You guys would know that.
Again, I go back to my initial comments. The arrests we're making are across the spectrum. We are seeing ages, genders, different occupations. Unfortunately, drinking is an accepted norm. It's taken to the nth degree, and DUIs tend to occur. I would also like to comment on his question, if I may. Mm-hmm. Law enforcement generally, and I agree with Judge Guido, DUI repeat offenders are a significant problem. I mean, they are a danger to everybody on the roadway. I think in law enforcement, however, I think our strokes are a little bit broader. I think it wouldn't probably be out of reason for us to throw domestic violence into that area of a special concern. One of the problems we have with domestic violence, and unfortunately, I don't think a lot of these folks end up in front of Judge Guido, is because we have one heck of a time getting them prosecuted. We have a very difficult time, despite our best efforts, in getting these cases to court simply because a multitude of reasons, which would probably be the subject of an entirely different forum, our victims don't necessarily stay victims after the initial arrest takes place. So, yes, drunk drivers are a concern. Repeat drunk drivers, we don't hesitate to put handcuffs on them. But the domestic violence perpetrators are as big a concern for law enforcement as anything else. They escalate their violence, and we have a very difficult time getting prosecutions because of the myriad of facts and threats that tend to be posed against the crime victim.
In fact, when you mentioned that 93% were property crimes, only about 7% violent crimes in 2009,
right.
It's also interesting what percentage, if you have a rough estimate, of those may be domestic violence or intimate partner crimes.
Simple assaults are generally part two crimes. Our UCR numbers that Dee alluded to are part one and part two. Part ones are specifically murder, rape, robbery, aggravated assault, burglary, and some of the more heinous crimes. Domestic violence are typically simple assaults, and those are part two crimes. If I was to sit here with no statistics in front of me, I would tell you that domestic violence make up probably 60 to 65% of our simple assault arrest. Pennsylvania has some very good tools that law enforcement can use when it comes to making domestic violence arrests. Specifically, if I show up on the scene and I see signs of abuse and I see physical injury, I am bound by statute to make the arrest. Many, 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 many years ago, you know, the old habit of, well, you know, you go to this corner and you go in this corner and everybody will be fine in the morning, that doesn't happen anymore. If we see signs of abuse, we're going to arrest you. If we see physical injury, you're leaving. Doesn't matter if the victim wants to be a victim, you're going in the back of our car and you're going to go down to booking. That's the way it happens. The problem is, however, getting it past that stage, getting the victim into court and getting the case prosecuted. However, the largest number of our simple assault arrests are made up by domestic violence incidents.
Hi. I was wondering, specifically on campus, but also for all of you. I think a lot of times crime victims are usually gendered, so we usually talk about women more often as victims. And I think that's especially true. I don't think necessarily that the language or the pamphlets and stuff are tailored to women, but I think we always talk about it much more, that women are much more likely. I think we encourage women to walk in partners more than we talk to men. So what I was wondering, if statistics back that up, are women more likely to be victims than men? And how can we sort of, I guess, change the perspective or understand better why we talk about women as victims more often than we talk about men?
I think you're absolutely right, and that's one of the things that we've tried to do, is shift away from that woman-focused message, which is, if you see some of the things on the safety pamphlets we handed out to first years and on the bookmarks, there's no gender mention. It's, you know, don't walk alone, period. I will tell you that I think from college student perspective, we've had almost as many male students walking alone at night, especially after they've been under the influence of alcohol, have become victims of crime. The key is not being alone, period. I think that men, it's not uncommon to see men travel more in groups sometimes here in town from party to party. You know, a group might be just two or three people, but I very often see a lone woman on campus more than I see a lone man. I don't know why that happens. But that's the reality. But if you look at victimization, we've had quite a number. I can think of a robbery case mm-hmm. last year just off campus, which was a solo student, a male student who also fought back and called the police immediately. I mean, the best two things you could do in that situation. But I think by and large, you know, all the literature is focused towards women, and we've kind of made a conscious effort in public safety for this school year to kind of focus more on just a general message, not specifically if you're a woman, walk alone, or a man, walk alone. Don't walk alone.
And I will concur with Dee's comments. For whatever reason, when we see the males walking away from the bars and so forth at night, they tend to go in groups. Several of the instances where solo males were victims, you know, at least one or two of those, there was intoxication involved. And that makes prosecution and trying to make an arrest, it's a major headache, because you're dealing with somebody whose perception of the description of the perpetrator, the time frame, everything is skewed because of the alcohol. Too short.
Hi, I have heard of a lot of good reports on the Dickinson Safe Ride program, but I've also heard a few instances of people waiting and having the Safe Ride never actually show up for more than 20 minutes. And I was wondering if this problem has actually been addressed with public safety before, because even a 5-minute wait is too much of a wait when you're in a tough situation.
Absolutely. Well, if you're from the community, what Safe Ride is, actually we changed the name to Safe Walk last year, is a program where we don't want students to walk alone. So they could call public safety and we'll send an officer to walk along with you, or if it's a bicycle officer, ride along with you. We try to get to those calls as quick as possible, but the reality is that calls are prioritized when they come into any police department, including the college police department. And if we are dealing with, just say, a fight and an assault and a fire alarm on campus, the Safe Walk would get knocked down a little bit in priority. And very often you have to understand there's one officer on duty on campus. After dark, generally two. But that's part of the issue. So we try to get there as quick as possible. I know for the person that's waiting for the ride, it's a priority. But if somebody's bleeding and we're dealing to them medically, that, frankly, is the priority for the officers. There is a solution, however. Working with Student Senate, we were able to move some funding around that hopefully by the end of the semester, at end of September, we're going to have a program in place called the Safety Shuttle. And that's going to run from 9 o'clock at night till 3 o'clock in the morning, 7 days a week, for students any place in the borough of Carlisle. So if you had to go to Walmart in the middle of the night for something, this would apply. Right now what we're doing is hiring students and others. So if you are a student, you're looking for a student job, all you have to do is contact public safety, Lieutenant Fazio, Joe Fazio, explain to him your interest. We're trying to hire this group of students. So all these shuttle requests, all these shuttles would be student-driven, student-run, and it'll deal with a lot of the problems. There won't be, you know, their main job will be to respond to a request for a safe ride, not being up doing other things at the same time. So that, I mean, we try to get to them as expeditiously as possible, but the reality is sometimes if one officer's handling three things at one time. I would love to if I was funded to have more officers. Actually, we actually lost a position. We have 14 officers. We had 15. Things, you know, with the economy, things get moved around. Right now, actually, I have an officer opening, an officer left, and we're short one more. We're trying to hire to fill that position right now. I think, honestly, it's not the best use of an officer, a police officer, to do these. I think it's better use of a student worker or a student who's looking to make some good part-time pay. To drive the van and take students from place to place. I also think it'll encourage more students to use it, especially somebody who's maybe had something to drink, because even if they're underage, they would be less concerned about getting in trouble if it was a student driving instead of an officer. So.
Hi, my name is Stan. I'm Brenda Landis. I actually work here, but I'm here more as a resident, and I'm part of the West Side Neighbors Association, which is a fairly newly formed
organization. Can you speak up a little
bit? Oh, sorry. Fairly newly formed organization. And I just wanted to address that there was something that wasn't brought up when you guys were talking about ways to prevent crime, you know, walking with someone at night and, you know, locking your doors and your car and everything, but something that the neighborhood organizations have been promoting, and it's very simple and cheap and everyone in the community can do it, including college students especially that are off campus, is leaving their porch lights on. And I don't really have any statistics, but I mean, I was just wondering if you can back that up to help give us some backup on our cause there. But unfortunately, we also get the flack, which we're really sustainable here at Dickinson, and that's awesome. But a porch light doesn't cost that much, and you can get those nice CFLs that don't suck very much energy and will cost you maybe like $3 a year or something to run. So would you agree, though, that just having some extra light on the
back.
Street?
You're good. In fact, I will up that with saying motion lights are the best thing going since running water. I've been on foot patrol and had a motion light kick on, and it scared the crap out of me. And I wasn't breaking any law. So if you're trying to break the law and the light comes on, and all of a sudden you're like, oh, my gosh, it's the best thing going. So, yes.
And that's what, absolutely, I agree. One of the cheapest deterrents to crime is to keep your outside lights on. And once a year we do a safety walk on campus. Student Senate, other students are invited. We bring facilities people, and we walk the entire campus. And when we see areas that are dark or areas that have porch lights where they're not in repair, college-owned buildings, or very often we'll have students who will unscrew the light bulbs because they're trying to save energy, we'll screw them back in. But it's something, absolutely, lighting up an area certainly helps reduce crime. My house, I live in North Middle, and you can probably see it from the air at night.
I think we have time for one or two more questions.
Hi, my question is for Mike Drzezinski. What constitutes a crime making the newspaper in Carlisle?
I'm sorry, what?
What constitutes a crime making the newspaper?
Well, that would actually, I can tell you what the Carlisle Police Department does as far as press releases, and then if you turn around and ask those folks in the back, they can probably explain to you how they determine what gets printed and what doesn't. Carlisle Police Department has a very proactive policy when it comes to press releases, and what I mean by that, every time a police report is generated that does not involve an undercover drug operation or a sexual assault, where we need to probably keep that information closer to the chest than normal, every one of those instances generates a press release. Those go through my office every morning. As Lieutenant Guido will point out, I will chase them down the hall if they don't get the press releases done before they leave. So we generate a press release for every incident that occurs, theft from a vehicle, robbery, anything like that. Some instances we have to keep those things tight till we make the arrest, but even then, once the arrest is made, the press release is put out. So I will tell you that we are probably the most progressive department I've ever seen in doing the press releases. In addition to that, every crime report goes on our crimereports.com map. So if I generate a report for a theft of a motorcycle, The press release will generally go out that following morning or that following business day. The following day, it'll also show up on the crime report's map. So if for some reason the media or the local newspaper doesn't have enough print space to print it, it will still show up on our crime report map. And in fact, if you sign up for the alert, you'll actually be alerted to when crimes occur within a certain geographic area, which can be determined by you. You can actually be notified by email. So we brought the crime report system in to not only help out our neighborhood groups, but also to help you as a citizen understand that we can't control what's printed and what's put on the evening news, but we can sure let you know every time a crime's going to happen. And that crimereports.com, we actually brought that through this year. Dee had alluded to it, and if I may talk about it for one, just a few seconds, if I may. That site is actually something the borough subscribes to because we wanted to get the information out there to the population of the borough. Anybody across the country can use that. You simply go into crimereports.com, you type in your address, and you can actually see all of the crimes that occur within a geographic area. You can determine whether you want to look at 7 days' worth of data or a month's worth of data. If you type a month, that map will actually populate with all the crimes that have occurred within every geographic area you've chosen. All those incidents are coded. They'll actually give you an incident number. They'll tell you whether or not the case is under investigation, whether it's closed. It'll tell you if it's an assault, if it's a theft, if it's a retail theft, and all that good stuff. So that information's out there. It's free. You don't have to subscribe to it. Anybody with the internet access can go on. If you want to subscribe to the alerts, you basically type in your email address. You say, here's where I want to know when crimes occur, and they will actually notify you whenever a crime comes up on a map that's within that certain geographic area that you choose. Our neighborhood organizations, which we are very proud of, have actually started to lay templates on our crime report map to show the span of their control and the areas of their concern. So we're very proud of that, and even if it doesn't show up in the paper, that's a very good resource for you to be informed.
It's definitely a pretty great technology. I get it on my BlackBerry every day. It's important to me to know what's going on around campus, and it was just as easy, like Mike said, you just go on crimereports.com, you subscribe, it's free, you give your address, and you get an email about what's going on.
They actually have a beta version out right now that you can actually play with. It's a 2.0 where you can establish neighborhood groups. You know, if you and somebody else want to sign up for a certain segment of the boundaries within the borough, you can establish a group so that you're notified and you're resourced on that map.
Did anyone from the media want to respond to that?
No question. I think I'm the only one here.
Sentinel Patriot, nobody's going to acknowledge him.
I think it was,
My name's Craig Lane. I'm from Fox 43. What was the question again?
The question is, how is it decided? What gets in the newspaper?
It largely is determined on the editorial staff. I mean, we have a news director. We have an executive producer. We have two associate producers and assignment desk staff. When I walk in the morning, or in this case, at 3 o'clock this evening, they ask me, you know, Craig, do you have any ideas? Do you know what's going on? My beat is Cumberland, Dauphin counties, Lebanon, Franklin, depending on where they send me. But it's usually up here in the northern part of central Pennsylvania. And basically, what we cover is largely determined by what's happening that day or if we set something up. And I'll tell you what, Lieutenant Dzinski knows all of our faces in the media. And the department is very open and very helpful. You said one of the most progressive. We always get releases from you guys, and it's great. So thank you for that. You've got a great police department. Very, very open and very helpful. The one thing I will say is, you know, it's that old adage, if it bleeds, it leads. It's sad, and it's true. Nothing like murder. We just came from the 11th homicide. That's where I was at 6:30. I was live in front of the Harrisburg Police Station. So that's largely the way we make decisions. Sometimes it's if it affects the more people. Sometimes if it's out of the ordinary. One of the reasons that sometimes we cover things in Carlisle that are crimes are because, like he said, it doesn't happen very much here. And so that tends to surprise a lot of people. So anyway, I think that's the best answer I can give you right now.
And if you want to know crime on campus, I mean, the public safety website and in the Dickinsonian, the student newspaper, we've got a police log, police blotter on our website, which is updated on a daily basis. It gets kind of boring sometimes, fire alarm, fire alarm, fire alarm. But everything that we basically respond to is on there.
But one more question. Good evening. I'm June Shoemaker, a member of the community. I want to thank the panel for your excellent information. It's certainly worthwhile. I wish there were more people here to hear it. My question regards the homeless, and this is directed particularly to Lieutenant. Homeless numbers are increasing in our area. The problem is addressed by a number of agencies in our area, and they do an amazing job. And my question is, how are homeless or transients affecting our crime statistics, either by them or to them, on campus or in the community at large?
Talk about the community at large. Go ahead.
Right. I think there has been a certain amount of concentration on the homeless population within the last year, especially with the new homeless shelter opening up and so forth. The homeless have always been a concern of the Carlisle Police Department. Since I was sworn in 1994, the homeless have always had a presence within Carlisle. Did you see them? Not generally. They were living in the parks. They were living in Thornwall. They were living in Santa Gables. They were there. It just wasn't something you saw every day. Now that we have various resources, Carlisle Cares and the homeless center in town, that is drawing them out of the woods and out of the areas where they've been generally staying, and you are seeing them more. Do we, as a police department, have routine dealings with them? Yes. Are those dealings any more than they have always been? No, they are not. We generally always try to do foot patrol in the woods because we generally want to keep an eye on what was going on back there. Now we don't necessarily have to walk through the woods because they are brought out and they are typically at one of our local homeless resource shelters. Carlisle is unique, and that uniqueness is a positive, and I have to look at it that way. We have the county seat here. We have resources here. Social Security, homeless shelters, Salvation Army, the law school, the college, the courthouse, all of those things that tend to make some people look at it negatively are a positive. And what I mean by that is you can walk down the streets of Carlisle and talk to somebody who has been through so many life experiences that you could spend an hour listening to them, and you can go up the other direction and talk to a college professor who's got a different set of experiences. When you're on foot patrol, you know, you tend to encounter homeless people. It happens. The key there is whether or not you take the time to talk to them. And if, Mike, I don't want to put you on the spot here, but Lieutenant Guido, then Sergeant Guido with Carlisle Police Department, he's a great conversationalist. He loved to talk to people. And when you took a few minutes to talk to those homeless people, the stories are bewildering. The things they've experienced, the things that brought them here to Carlisle, it's a wealth of information. Do they want to be in that situation? Generally, no. Do we have a certain segment of homeless population that caused their own demise? To some extent, yes. Those are the ones you're reading about the paper. Those are the ones that showed up at the shelter drunk. Those are the ones that are getting into fights in the square. We make the arrest. We put the information in the paper. They attract a certain amount of attention. But when you look at the totality of the amount of homeless people that are generally in our Carlisle area, they are the small majority. Do I wish they had better circumstances? Yes. Are they always going to be in Carlisle? As long as we're the county seat and we have those resources, they're going to be here. The best thing that we can do is try and keep them provided for, try and keep them in the open, and try and keep track of what we can do to make their lives better, work their steps up, and get them out of that homeless situation. There's nothing worse than walking through the local park. It's 98 degrees, humidity is off the scale, and you've got somebody who's laying there in long pants, all coiled up in his tent because those are his possessions. Number one, I can't do anything for him, and number two, I need to try and provide a safe, secure environment for the residents of the borough while also making sure that this person, good, bad, or indifferent, doesn't end up dying in the woods that day. So it's a balancing act. We think we do a good job of it. Please rest assured that the homeless population that you read about in the paper that get in trouble are the small percentage of the folks that we actually deal with.
As far as on campus, the vast majority of crime on campus is student-on-student crime, whether it be theft, taking something from somebody's room, or assaults. That's the reality. The situation earlier in the year with Mr. Legs that committed the two assaults and was arrested, he was a transient individual, mm-hmm. but that's not the norm. With that said, the college is private property, so we do have some control over our facilities and grounds, but we also understand we're part of the community. So many of our buildings at many hours are open to anybody in the community, things like our library. But there are certainly buildings after certain hours of time are restricted to students, or to faculty staff. And when we do, we have plenty of homeless people visit our library, and that's not a problem until there is a problem, which doesn't happen all that often.
The homeless people that are on the radar aren't our biggest concern. Absolutely. And what I mean by that is Carlisle Cares, the local shelters, they have a screening program. Those people that want shelter have to report to the Carlisle Police Department. They have to show us a photo ID. We're going to compare them against the ban list, which is basically a list of people who didn't behave, and now they're not going back. And then we're going to run a wanted persons check. It's not a criminal history check. It's a wanted persons check. That means that we're making sure they don't have any active warrants anywhere across the country. Once they go through that screening process, then they go into local shelters. Those aren't the ones we're generally concerned about. It's the ones that fall off the radar. They're Mr. Legs, the ones who we aren't aware of that are in town, the ones who are skulking around in the middle of the night and so forth and going into the woods and sleeping and so forth. Those are the ones we're concerned about.
Thank you. And I think one of the students is doing the final wrap-up.
Please join me in thanking our panelists. And this concludes our event. Thank you for attending.